I interviewed Susan Rosenberg in her New York City apartment on April 16th. Susan was released from federal prison January 20th, 2001, one of over 400 prisoners who received clemency from President Clinton. Susan, you served over 16 years in prison for...
For the possession of weapons and explosives. Actually, when I was sentenced along with Timothy Blunk, which was in 1985, we were given the longest sentence ever for possession of weapons. And that was what we were both doing time for. We were part of the anti-imperialist left that came out of the student movement in the 60s that then developed and evolved through the 70s. And we had become involved with illegal resistance to the United States government. And when we were arrested, it was the beginning of Reagan, and we were going to be a lesson for people, which is why we were given the kind of sentence that we were given.
So basically you were given 56-year sentences because you were radical leftists.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we were given that sentence. We were convicted of possession, and at the same time that we were arrested for this, there were a number of people from the Ku Klux Klan and the Order who had also been arrested, and they were given sentences of 5 to 8 years, and they all did even less time than that. So for us at the time, it was very clear that it was a political message as well as a criminal conviction by the government.
And how much time did Timothy end up serving?
Tim served a little over 12 years, 12 plus, I think, and he was released on parole. It'll be 5 years ago now, I guess, in March. And basically, the way federal sentencing works is that you make, if this was before the new laws went into effect, which were in 1987, basically, if you got a sentence of over 30 years, your sentence was 30 years. Nobody did more than 30 years in federal prison. And what that meant was that you were eligible for parole after serving a third of it. So we were eligible for parole under the system we were sentenced under after 10 years. So in 1995, both of us became eligible for parole.
And why weren't you paroled?
Well, I wasn't paroled because I had in my what is called jacket. My jacket from the government basically is what you get when you are wanted by the government or captured by the government or then jailed by the government. My jacket was very different than Tim's in the sense that I had been indicted in a case in New York that was the first conspiracy case against the Black Liberation Movement, a RICO conspiracy case that involved a large number of people in the Black Liberation Movement and people who were supporters of the Black Liberation Movement. And it become known in the popular vernacular as the Brinks case, but it was really much more than that. It was a political conspiracy case that was targeting some of the most radical elements in the Black movement. I had been indicted in that case, and then I had fled from the charges in that case. I was then later arrested in New Jersey for possession of weapons, and the government turned around and dropped the charges against me in this Black Liberation conspiracy case.
So you were underground at the time of your arrest?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so, to answer your question, that case, even though the government refused to prosecute me on it, was then brought up when I went to the Parole Commission in 1998 and told that because of that case being in my record, despite the fact that there was no prosecution involved, was going to be held, I would be held accountable for that case, and therefore given a 15-year set-off date for parole.
So even though you were never tried, never convicted, never given a chance to be found innocent. You know, I mean, kind of, we sort of think innocent until proven guilty in this
right.
country. You were just continued to be held in prison
right.
because of that.
Right. For, you know, a number of years, I basically, the way I look at it was that I was held without trial, with absolute violation of all due process for over 3 years.
And let's talk a little bit about the political scene at the time of your arrest and a little bit before, because you were politically active for years before your arrest.
Oh, yeah. I was a political activist and a social activist in the left in New York. I had been involved in doing work against drugs in the community. I had been working at Lincoln Hospital and was trained as a doctor of acupuncture. I was involved in COINTELPRO exposures in the very beginning of sort of exposing what the counterintelligence program had been. I was also involved in doing work about against the Ku Klux Klan. I was in the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. This was all in the sort of middle 70s. So I was definitely part of the radical movement in this country and in this city. And I think that part of what happened in the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s was that there was this war that was going on in Central America that the United States was engaged in prosecuting against people's movements for liberation there. And there was also a real backing off of many, many people who had been socially active at the time. And so some of us felt that that was not the way to go and that the struggle for social justice was a struggle that you carried on forever. And so one thing kind of, you know, sort of led to another.
We're speaking with Susan Rosenberg, political prisoner for over 16 years.
Shortly after your conviction, you were sent to the Lexington High Security Unit, built especially for women political prisoners. Can you tell us about this special prison, about how it worked, and then how the prisoners and your supporters on the outside finally shut it down?
Yes. Let me just say one thing to set a context about this, is that there was a very small minority of people who were in the revolutionary movement in the United States in this period. And I think that the government's position was that if they could isolate us successfully and separate us from the political movements that existed and to draw a line between people who actually were illegally involved in fighting against the United States government versus people who weren't, and make that divide very, very clear and very strong, they would be able to isolate us and destroy us and cut whatever ties or support that we had before we went to jail or while we were in jail. And so the Lexington High Security Unit fell into that strategy by the United States. At that time, the German government was involved in building isolation units in Stammheim, and it was against the radical movement in Germany. And Mies, at the time, was the U.S. Attorney General in the Justice Department, and there was a whole consolidated anti-terrorism effort by the government. So Lexington fell into that whole movement by the government at that point in history. The Lexington High Security Unit was the first political prison built for women political prisoners. The truth was that there were only three of us that were ever there. And it existed for 2 years, although it had been in the planning stages for a couple of years before that, before it opened. I was transferred there with Alejandrina Torres, one of the Puerto Rican prisoners of war. We were both in Tucson, Arizona, being held in a men's prison waiting for Lexington to be built in 1986. And we got to Lexington in October of 86, and we were the first two people there. And for 3.5 months, we were the only people there. The Lexington High Security Unit, I have been in a lot of prisons over the last 16 years, and in a lot of very, very bad prison conditions. I would say that Lexington was the most extreme because it was an experiment and it was designed to break our political and social and cultural will, our spirits, if you will. And they said that, and they said that to us. And in the end, the fact that they said that to us and put it on paper was their own undoing, in conjunction with all of the struggle that happened against it. They basically said to us, if you change your associations and your politics, then we'll let you go to general population. And we laughed and said, general population is a privilege? We don't think so.
So how long were you at Lexington before we won the battle to shut it down?
Well, we were there not quite 2 years. Everyone was there not quite 2 years. The third person who was ultimately transferred there was Sylvia Baraldini, who was also a political prisoner. And then Sylvia and I sued the Bureau of Prisons, and there was at the same time that there was litigation, there was also a human rights struggle that went on by lots of people from the human rights movement, from the churches, from the synagogues, from the community.
It's a national movement.
It was, and it was successful. It was closed in August of 1990. 1989.
Right.
We were all sent to different places after Lexington was court-ordered closed. Sylvia went to New York. I think Alejandrina went to California, and I was in Washington, D.C. At the time. So we were all separated, and then Sylvia and I were sent later to the maximum security unit that they opened to take the place of Lexington, which was in Marianna, Florida. And I was there for 5 years in the maximum security unit in Florida. And when I was trying to get to general population so that I could get to Danbury, which would be closer to my home and to my family, it was completely opposed by the Bureau of Prisons. I think it's sort of the treatment of political prisoners in contradistinction to other prisoners is underscored by the fact of how some of us as women political folk were treated by the Bureau of Prisons. And I would say that from 1985 until 1995, when I did finally in May of 95 get to Danbury, I was in the most extreme conditions of isolation or small group isolation or segregation over 10 years, which I think is one of the longest examples of that, certainly in the United States. I don't know, and there's other grave human rights violations and abuses against people in other countries as well. But I think it stands among a handful of people's experiences. And it was strictly because of who I was and what the government perceived that I represented and stood for.
So you were locked in by yourself a lot of the time, 23-hour lockdown?
I was locked up in small units. I was allowed out of my cell for periods of the day. I wasn't the emergence of control units. This is part of the history of how that developed, so that now we have a situation where over a quarter of the people in prison are in these 23-hour lockdown single-cell units. But this was all part of that process.
Okay, so let's go back to the support for political prisoners and the kinds of visits that you would get. And
well, at Lexington, we had very few visits. At Lexington, the first 14 months, we had no social visits at all. We had legal visits and our most immediate family. We were not allowed visits from other people. And then after a point because of the political pressure and the litigation, some of the rules were modified slightly so that we did have some visits. But I will say that visits weren't necessarily the test of whether or not we had support, because we knew that there was a struggle that was going on the outside about what was happening to us on the inside. We were aware of it. And I think that the Lexington campaign in some ways was, for a long period, the last campaign of that nature where there was a victory of stopping the advance of repression right at the point where it was going on. I think part of why that could happen was because it was such a blatant example of that, because we were women, because the Puerto Rican independence movement was at a point of development that had embraced its own prisoners very much, and we certainly, as people in solidarity with that, benefited from that, as well as were in support of it. I think there was a combination of factors that made Lexington somewhat unique. I always felt subsequent to that I wished that level of work had gone on about a lot of things that happened afterwards, not just to me personally, obviously, but to a whole spectrum of people and experiences. I think that's beginning to change now. Again, I can see. I didn't think that until I got out. But now it's clear to me that there is a growing or a reemergence again of a response to this incredible drive to lock everybody up. I mean, I personally feel, just to say in terms of the question of support and the issues about that any progressive movement that doesn't defend its people who go to jail is not a movement that is going to be too effective. And there was always a group of people from the movement that came out of the 60s and 70s who continued to fight for us. And so it may have been very small at points, and I think that it was very small. But I also think that certainly I can just say for myself, I never felt completely alone. Even if I was completely alone, I never felt abandoned in spirit or in terms of the fact that there were still some ties that were binding. On the other hand, I'm not sure how effective those ties have been able to be, because they're not massive enough, because we haven't penetrated the culture that we live in beyond a certain sort of narrow framework. And that's, I think, something that with Linda Evans and my release, I think every victory can create another victory. And I think that's part of what we have to do.
Right. Continue the fight to free Marilyn Buck. Leonard Peltier, Leah,
and I think even at some level more generally, although obviously that is totally crucial, but more generally, I think that the whole idea that prisoners in this country have been so demonized and so criminalized and so dehumanized, and that it has worked, it has been so effective, and it really is, I mean, it's a code word on another level about race and who is in American prisons, that until some of those really big, big things can begin to be broken, and slowly, I hope and think they may be, I don't think we're going to even free the political prisoners, because I think that those things really go hand in hand.
I'm speaking with Susan Rosenberg, who was a political prisoner for over 16 years.
The Lexington High Security Unit was an extreme example of prison control. What was ordinary life like in Danbury? Did you have meaningful work there? Or what's a social life like in prison?
I think different prisons are different. And one of the things that I've been really struck by in getting out is how little, generally, even academics involved in criminal justice issues or people involved in sort of the broad social justice issues know nothing about the federal prison system. The federal prison system is the least exposed and least understood, and it's really blown my mind, actually. There's lots of knowledge about state prisons, California State Prison, New York State Prison. But in terms of the federal government, they're about to reinstitute the death penalty in the federal system. And I think that the federal system really is worth examining, because the federal system is the political leadership of the prison systems in this country as a whole, and they are the flagship prison system in the whole world. I can't tell you how many tours of international prison officials I watched walk through prison after prison over all these years, because they were being studied by the Irish, by the English, by the Germans, by the Japanese, by every country in the world. And it is the Bureau of Prisons that is, you know, vanguarding that process. So having said that, I would say that the idea that life in federal prison is like in a hotel, which is the general population's view, certainly not our view, but is the view, is so off base and so... it is indicative of how well the Bureau of Prisons has been able to keep a lid on what, in fact, is going on there. In terms of women, in terms of Danbury, the issues at Danbury... Danbury is one of the oldest federal prisons built in this country. I think it was built in 1938. It's been rebuilt, but not really. And so it was built to hold 500 men who, at the time, no one ever did more than 5 years in. There are now 1,300 women in a space that should have, you know, contained at a maximum 500 people. And the way that people live are in barrack-style housing. And people are expected to live in what they call cubicles for 5, 7, 10, 12 years. Okay, so if imagine you're in a barn, and the stall that you're in, the height of the stall only goes up to the second level, so that there's no difference when you're sleeping on the top bunk between you and the person that's next to you. There's no division, there's no wall. So you're lined in a row. And I think, you know, the idea that women will accept this, that women are basically being treated as animals, is kind of the sort of the watchword of the prison's willingness to just keep people in the most profound conditions. You know, there's also life in prison, and both things exist at the same time. There's horrible conditions, and then there's what you make of it. There's what you do when you're existing in that kind of society. For me, getting to population was actually a really great thing. Because isolation, even when you fight it and you resist it and people are trying to oppose it, isolation works. And so when I got to population, I was able to get a job. I was able to work in the community that I lived in the prison community. You know, and I became a teacher. That's what I did. I worked in the education department there for several years.
And you were in isolation for how many years before you got into general population?
10 years
of isolation.
Of one kind or another. I don't want to overstate the case, but, you know, essentially, maximum security isolation,
And so you taught, and I know a lot of the political prisoners also did lots of AIDS education work.
I did that, yeah. I mean, I did that for a long time. I actually did that in the maximum security unit at Mariana. And started an AIDS education program there as well. But in Danbury, we did, and people are doing it still, AIDS education. Basically, in that situation, prisoners are the advocates for people with AIDS in that community. But I worked there as primarily an adult continuing education instructor, and I was able to teach English and history and black history and creative writing and a bunch of courses that I thought were, you know, useful and important, and I think benefited the community there. And I miss that part of my life in prison. I miss having a community of people who were involved in trying to take responsibility for themselves and to gain education. And I met some amazing people in prison. And, you know, the last year and a half that I was at Danbury, I was the only political prisoner there. And so, you know, you just have to figure out how you exist in that kind of situation. And what I found was that I could relate to and be with and talk to everyone. And it made life bearable.
So the other political prisoners that were in Danbury, Sylvia and Alejandrina, both...
Right. And we ended up all being put in Danbury, even though we had all been together at Lexington. We were never at Dublin with all the other political women that were there.
So you served over 16 years in prison and clearly went through many, many changes during that time. How did your politics change during that time?
I would say that my ideologies, of which I had several, changed a lot. I would say that sort of core beliefs and values about the world and justice and peace and racism and what is my responsibility in all of those things didn't change. But I would say that, you know, I think a thinking person can't be incarcerated for all that time and watch the world and the movement and the globe go through changes. I watched the Berlin Wall fall on television. Now, that's a long time ago already. You know, I watched and read about the end of the Soviet Union. And so I don't think a person who... And I watched the peace negotiation process in Central America and in Ireland and in places in Europe all in the 80s where people said we are the price of our struggle, the cost in human cost has to change. And I was very affected by those things that I witnessed as a political person. And I also obviously got to spend a huge amount of time, more than I would wish on anybody, to evaluate the history of my own participation in the movement. So I would say that one big change is that I think that our attempt at political change through political violence was a mistake and was something that did not help anybody, particularly in the struggle for justice, social justice, and change in this country. And I would say probably that's the biggest ideological, political position change that I made from when I went in to now. There are a lot of other changes, too, but I would say probably that would be a big one.
And... would you say, well, are you like endorsing nonviolent struggle over armed struggle? Or are you saying in some circumstances?
I'm not endorsing one thing or another. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, this is kind of a hard topic because, you know, it's so loaded in so many ways.
Sure.
So I can't say I'm endorsing one thing or another. I am saying that I think that... The question let me just say for myself, not in general, because I can't really speak in general, but for myself, the issue of having participated in a small group that thought we could make change through armed propaganda, which is what we were involved in and thought would have an effect, I feel I wouldn't repeat ever again. And I think that in the conditions that existed in this country at that time, to think that we could have that effect, I think was probably so off mark and so off base that, and I think that it was bred in part from political arrogance. And, you know, when you make a decision that you're going to be involved with political violence in one form or another, even though you may take the most incredible precautions, you are basically taking onto yourself that you have the right to make certain decisions about life and death. And frankly, for myself, I would never want to be in that position again. I certainly don't feel badly at all about having done 16 plus in prison for political beliefs and political actions. So for me, both of those things exist side by side.
How did it come that you were considered for clemency? You know, we hear a lot about Clinton receiving millions of dollars from this person and that person. I find it hard to believe that all these political people were able to raise that kind of money to get out of jail.
Right. My lawyers are still waiting for the $400,000, which, of course, they're never going to see. I mean, I didn't buy this clemency. I might have nudged for this clemency, but I can't. There's nothing to investigate with regard to my clemency petition. I would say that I thought that there was a chance that I would get clemency because I watched President Clinton give clemency to the Puerto Ricans. I watched him transfer Sylvia Baraldini to Italy, and I felt that the issues in my case, if it could get put before him on the merits, in the sense that the issue of due process, the issue of excessive sentencing to begin with, the issue of disproportionality of sentencing between us and the right wing, and then the disproportionality or disparity between me and my co-defendant, altogether meant that there really was a strong reason to let me out, whether it had been through clemency or it had been through honest evaluation by a parole commission, which, of course, was never going to do that and doesn't do that to anybody who goes before it. Very, very rarely are they in any way just in terms of the kinds of decisions that they make. So I felt that in April of 2000, I decided that I should apply for clemency, and I basically I had enough legal help and support, because I have been in this struggle for a long time, to get a really great petition together that made the same argument that I'm making, you know, sort of restating now. And Jane Aiken and Mario Milvany were the two main lawyers who did my clemency work and petition. They were not the only people, but they were really the main people in the process of this. And we filed it at the end of August. And then because I had known people, and this is part of the issue to me about sort of the political left, is that in general the political left supported the clemency process, but it wasn't the political left that, you know, actually made that happen for me. Much more, I think, because I have ties to lots of different communities, the Jewish community in New York, different academic communities. I went to school while I was at Danbury, and I got my master's degree from Antioch. And as a result of that, I had correspondence with lots of people who are, you know, in that kind of area. I think that sort of opened the pathway to say, okay, who can we go to in the political sphere that could make an argument to the president that this was worth doing? And so we were able to find that path and do it. You know, what happens now, just to sort of conclude this, is that, you know, all this hue and cry about people using the back door to get to the president. The point of the power of pardons for the president, or for the power of clemency, is to right a wrong that's gone through the process itself already. That's the point of the power. So, you know, all this bull about who talked to whom, that's what was supposed to happen. You know, now, was it supposed to be bought and paid for? That's a different question. Obviously not. And the other point, just to say, is that, you know, Leonard Peltier should have gotten clemency too. And I do feel completely upset about the fact that, you know, Linda and I got it, and we really, I think a lot of us thought Leonard had a really good chance at getting it. I believe that Leonard was told to pack before the 20th, which I was too. And so I can only imagine, you know, the horror of then at the end of it not getting it. I don't know all of the things that happened, but I believe that the FBI and the U.S. Justice Department said to President Clinton, you can't do that one.
Right.
you know. And I think that is, you know, indicative of some about the difference between Linda and I and Leonard, what Leonard represents in this country in a way that I don't know anyone else who does.
Let's back up to Danbury for a second and talk about the role of community radio for you in terms of staying in touch with what was going on in the world.
I love community radio. And community radio, I would say, certainly when I finally could hear it, because in Lexington, Kentucky, if there was community radio, I don't think we knew about it or could get it. And in Tucson, there was some progressive radio stations. And then in Florida, I don't think we didn't have too much radio in Florida. But when I did finally get to Danbury, there was a listener-sponsored radio station out of Bridgeport. And I want to say WPKN. I'm pretty sure that is the call letters. And WPKN saved my mental life. I mean, from the point of view of being able to listen to Pacifica, from the point of view of even being able to listen to NPR, but also to just have an alternative vision of the world seep through the walls. That made a huge difference. I actually am not now a visual person. I'm an audio person. I listen to the radio. People say to me, well, you know, you're always listening to the radio. Well, it's the legacy from having had only a radio.
Oh, every cell doesn't have a television to fry people's brains?
No. But every prisoner can buy a Walkman.
All right. That's what I thought. I'd heard a story that Lexington, that they stuck a TV in your room,
yes,
and they said, therefore, this is humane because
yes,
you have a television.
That's right. True, they
okay.
did. But that went the way of everything as soon as Lexington got closed.
What has been the most difficult adjustment for you since you were released on January 20th?
Leaving people inside, I think it's, and the way I talk about it or characterize it is, having a divided heart. And I would say that I love being free. I am astonished by the ability to have another chance in a free life. And I'm extremely happy to be free. It's just an incredible thing. But I think the thing that is definitely the hardest is that, you know, knowing every second of every day what people are living through inside is very, very hard. And I would also say that, you know, I feel that way both about all the political people inside, but also all of the people inside, because all of the people inside are suffering under these incredibly barbaric and unnecessarily cruel conditions that exist, whether it's in federal or state prison. So I think really for me, and I think it's true for any person who comes out, is that, you know, it's not the institutional life or any of the ways in which one sort of conforms to live, but is about the human beings that are there. And I know, you know, it's 5:45 and probably some people are still waiting online to eat dinner at Danbury, you know. So it's very visceral for me in that way. I think the other issues of transition are, for me, that, you know, I have to figure out how to live. And one thing that I finally realized a couple of weeks ago that was very helpful to me was that I was making this division between, like, my life inside and now. And I was kind of, like, creating this wall of which there was no in-between. And I don't think that's true, that for me, everything that happened up to this point, I bring to this point, which is why now I feel like I have to write this book, which is what I'm doing now. It's a prison memoir, And I think this period of transition where the old is so close to my heart, and in fact, it's all over my heart and my mind and my soul, and all of these challenges about being out now and how do I live and what do I do and what does it mean, have to be written about, you know, and that's kind of where I'm at now.
I think that sums it up. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the listeners?
I guess one thing I would like to say is that I think that every time people on the outside try and bridge the divide between the outside and the inside, it makes a difference. It makes a difference in ways that people on the outside just can't even begin to understand, and whether that is writing a letter, sending a book, doing a visit, contacting somebody. I mean, on some level, that's low-level kind of support, but it is that kind of support that then gets built into other kinds of support. And I think that, you know, that seems to me a way, a small way, in which we can begin to sort of say, people in prison are just simply incarcerated members of the same community as people on the outside.
Thank you, Susan Rosenberg.
You're welcome.
This interview with Susan Rosenberg, political prisoner for over 16 years, was produced by Bear and Betty Miller. And thanks to Rob Seifert for his technical expertise.
Govinda Dalton of Radioactive Productions recently attended a convention of users of open source software in San Francisco. He spoke with several of the attendees about new copyright laws that recently resulted in the arrest of a computer programmer and the effect of these laws on society.
And we are here at the Linux World Conference and Expo, and I'm speaking with
Patrick Bernstad.
There was one of the gentlemen was mentioning that there was going to be a march outside the Moscone Center here on Thursday. And what is that in reference to?
Okay, this is in reference to, and it's called the Free Dmitry March. Dmitry's, and I'll murder his last name like everybody else does, but Dmitry Skarloff, I believe, is a Russian programmer, about a mid-level programmer, who came over from Moscow to a convention in Las Vegas to give a presentation on of a little bit of program that he had written that could read e-books, electronic books, that had been encoded using the Adobe proprietary encoding script. When he was getting on the airplane, literally checking out from the hotel to get on the airplane, the FBI grabbed him at the checkout desk and handcuffed him and hauled him off. Took him to Oklahoma, had him in prison in Oklahoma for 2 weeks before they moved him up here to San Jose to arraign him. The charge was that he had violated the DCMA, the Digital Copyright Manipulation Act. I don't know exactly what the M is for, but a horrendous, terrible piece of literature that was eased through the U.S. Congress during the Lewinsky hearings and the grand Clinton impeachment thing, and this is what slimed in under the door in the meantime. Basically, probably the cut to the bottom line is if you do anything that violates the profit-making capacities of the corporations or the publishers of it, you're in the wrong. And the librarians in particular have been fighting this because it restricts the reuse for educational purposes almost entirely. It was never very favorably received by the programming community, and this really has brought things to a head.
I'm speaking with
Don Rosenberg.
Don Rosenberg, and what is your affiliation or your group here?
My company is Stromian Technologies. I do software licensing between software companies, OEM software licensing, getting software A inside software B.
Could you say that one more time?
Getting one piece of software incorporated into another piece of software.
And then dealing with the legal ramifications of the proprietary aspects of that?
Yes. I'm not a lawyer. I do the business issues. My focus is making sure the deal gets done. And, of course, I have to know enough about licensing and law and contracts to make sure that things work out all right. People usually have their attorneys look at the arrangements.
And you had mentioned something about the DMCA law, and maybe you could go into that a little bit.
The Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a very hot issue at the moment. It's the law that provides for the fact that if you take a technological protection device, it could be software code, to protect your intellectual property, anyone who defeats that or attempts to defeat it is guilty of a felony. And this makes a great many people annoyed because you can no longer reverse engineer for compatibility, which is allowed under copyright law. One of the ironies of the DMCA is it recognizes fair use under copyright law. It enumerates a number of fair uses, but practically speaking, you can't exercise that fair use without breaking the law, that is, without defeating the technological protection. For instance, the electronic books that the license says you cannot read aloud to your children, the electronic books that you can't loan to a friend or that expire after a certain point, you can't copy a few pages because they're all locked up. All of these fair use arrangements are effectively prevented by the technology.
Dmitry, I believe that's the gentleman's name from Russia.
Yes. I can't say a lot about Dmitry because I am concerned that he may very well be convictable of violating the DMCA. I don't know all the ins and outs of it. However, it's an interesting case. Personally, although I regret any pain to Dmitry, I would like to see it come forward to trial so people can find out just how bad the law is and do something about it. The only bodies that can do anything about it are the U.S. Congress and Supreme Court at this point. So it's going to have to assume a very high profile before anything happens.
Where did this law originate?
Basically with the intellectual property barons who control the entertainment industry. They were concerned about Napster-like copying, and electronic books are coming along. Once you digitize something, it's extremely easy to copy and distribute. So they were looking for legal teeth that would enforce the technological means of preventing copying and distribution. And basically, that's what this law does. It says that any sort of technology lock, no matter how feeble, is sacrosanct and can't be violated.
What are some of the other issues that revolve around the copyright issues or the proprietary rights from, you know, software that interfaces within other software programs?
Well, just coming back to copyright, the Sonny Bono Copyright Act extended copyrights considerably. Originally, they were 17 years, and then there was a provision to extend them an additional renewal period of 17 years. So you had a total of 34 years. But the intellectual property barons have pushed Congress to the point where they extend out beyond a century now. You may have heard of the parody someone did of Gone with the Wind from the slave's point of view called The Wind Done Gone. And the copyright holders for Gone with the Wind went into court to prevent that, saying that it was a derivative work of Gone with the Wind. That would never have been an issue if copyright hadn't been pushed out so far because that work was done practically 70 years ago. The only works coming now into public domain are about 1922, which means that a lot of our great American 20th century literature, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and so on, is still under copyright, so that you won't find it up on Project Gutenberg and you can't distribute it to your friends and the Dover people won't be publishing it. The digital transmission or digital form of any intellectual property means that it can be very easily distributed. It also means it can be easily protected, at least legally, so that you can tell what's happening. Under current laws, if you publish a book and someone buys a copy, after that he's free to loan it, he's free to resell it. All of these things now can be controlled if the property is digital and you put the software locks on it. An example of that are the DVDs that if you buy them in Europe won't work in a machine that's intended to run in America. What's interesting with digital television is that they're going to do things such as you can control the you can record the program as long as you're watching it on the same machine you recorded it on, but you can't pass the recording. Whereas now it's perfectly legal to, I believe, to tape a show and to share the tape with your friends. So the government expects basically all property to be accounted for. It's something like land. You don't find any piece of land that is not the property of someone, and if you haven't paid the taxes on it, it's on its way to becoming state property, at least until it's auctioned and has another owner. And intellectual property tends to follow the same path. And if you put something out truly in the public domain, you have to sign documents to that effect saying that it's public, and someone can pick it up and make a minor modification to it, and suddenly it's proprietary again.
That was Govinda Dalton of Radioactive Productions from the Linux World Convention in San Francisco. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a radical black journalist now on death row who many believe was railroaded for the shooting death of a Philadelphia police officer in 1981. Jamal, who was a member of the Black Panther Party, focused his reporting on racism and political corruption in Philadelphia. Organizations and even foreign governments around the world have denounced the conduct in his original trial, and his lawyers and supporters are calling for a new trial. Even this effort is meeting with stiff resistance, as it appears that the government is doing everything in its power to make sure that Jamal's eloquent voice is silenced. At a recent hearing, a judge refused to allow Mumia to be present, and a battle is raging over the court's apparent refusal to allow new testimony to be entered into the record, that of a man, Arnold Beverly, who was confessed to the killing of the officer that Jamal was convicted of slaying. One reason why Beverly's testimony may be meeting with such resistance is that Beverly says he is a contract killer, and he was hired by other members of the Philly police force involved with organized crime who were afraid that Faulkner was going to blow the whistle on them. Mumia's defenders have claimed all along that this was a frame-up and that it was racially and politically based. An affidavit from a new witness released at a press conference on August 28th in Philadelphia tells of hearing Mumia's trial judge express both bias and bigotry. This is what the affidavit says. I, Terry Moore Carter, declare, from approximately February 1982 through September 1986 and in 1998, I was employed as an official court stenographer in the Court of Common Pleas in and for the County of Philadelphia, 1st Judicial District of Pennsylvania. In April 1997, I first became a registered professional reporter. Thereafter, I obtained a certificate of merit. In approximately 1978, I became a federally certified court reporter. I have grand jury clearance. I have received awards of excellence from the states of Virginia and Maryland. In 1982, a few months after I started working in the Court of Common Pleas, I was sent to a courtroom different from that I usually worked in, because the judge I was assigned to was going to be doing violation of probation and post-verdict motion hearings there that day. I went through the anteroom on my way to that courtroom where Judge Szabo and another person were engaged in conversation. Judge Szabo was discussing the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. During the course of that conversation, I heard Judge Szabo say, quote, "Yeah, and I'm going to help them fry the nigger," close quote. There were three people present when Judge Szabo made that remark, including myself. The foregoing is stated subject to the penalties of 18 Pennsylvania CS Section 4904 relating to unsworn falsification to authorities, and is executed by me on August 21st, 2001, at Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Terry Moore Carter. A mass demonstration has been called in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal in Philadelphia on Saturday, September 15th. For more information, visit www.freemumia.com, FREEMUMIA.com. And we'll close with a commentary by the voice they seem to be trying so hard to silence, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
A federal civil rights trial in Philadelphia charging 7 former Greaterford prison guards with violating the civil rights of a number of prisoners by severely beating them while they were shackled and cuffed hand and foot revealed in glaring fashion how in prisons there is no law, there are no rights. Despite the guilty pleas and damning testimony of 5 ex-guards that they and their colleagues maliciously beat, kicked, stomped, blackjacked, and tasered, that is, used a handheld electric shocking device, prisoners who committed no institutional offenses, a civil jury acquitted the 7 of virtually all charges. One juror was quoted as saying, although it was proven that prisoners were badly beaten, no conspiracy was proven by U.S. prosecutors. One prisoner, who suffered from AIDS and thus had less internal resources with which to rebound from the horrific physical and psychological trauma he suffered in the beating, has since died. In the month-long trial, it was revealed guards thought 19 prisoners transferred from Camp Hill Prison shortly after rioters and rebels nearly leveled the central Pennsylvania facility to a pile of smoldering ashes were part of the rioting crews that ripped the prison apart. In fact, the 19 were non-rioters who were only too glad to be leaving what came to be called Camp Hell and to be coming to the state's largest and blackest prison, Greaterford. Instead, they were leaving the fire only to get simmered in the frying pan, so to speak. At Greaterford, whose massive haunting walls seem to offer some relief from the raging literal and psychic infernos of Camp Hill, the 19 men met uniformed hatred and naked brutality as they were beaten, kicked, and terrorized by government officials sworn to protect the elusive peace in prisons, guards who, acting on nothing but assumptions, assaulted over a dozen men on the notion that they were troublemakers. Some, those few who could navigate the treacherous straits and shoals of civil litigation, sued state officials for damages. Others bound up their wounds and blended into the wall while waiting for terms to expire so that they could be free again. Several testified in the federal prosecution. One died. But all found out how fragile the very system that stole their very freedom was when the state committed crimes against them. All found out that words like justice, law, civil rights, and yes, crime, have different and elastic meanings depending upon whose rights were violated, who committed what crimes against whom, and whether one works for the system or against it. For those people, almost 1 million at last count, who wear the label prisoner around their necks, there is no law, there is no justice, there are no rights. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
On September 27th through 30th, tens of thousands of global justice demonstrators will descend upon Washington, D.C., where the World Bank and International Monetary Fund will be holding their annual meetings. Come and find out why. There will be several teach-ins held in advance of the meeting on the issues in the Ithaca area. Cristobal Osorio Sanchez will speak on the topic, Did the World Bank Sponsor Genocide in Guatemala? Sanchez is a Guatemalan human rights activist and indigenous leader. His talk will focus on the World Bank-funded Chicxulub Dam and resulting Rio Negro massacres. He will be speaking at the following venues. On Monday, September 10th, at 7 p.m., at GIAC at the corner of Albany and Court Streets in Ithaca. Tuesday, September 11th, at the Clark Lounge in the Campus Center at Ithaca College at noon, and on Tuesday, September 11th, at the Founders Room at Annabelle Taylor Hall on the Cornell campus at 4 o'clock p.m. So that's Monday and Tuesday. If you want to learn how to join Ithaca activists in Washington, D.C., contact Kuslar at Kuslar at Cornell.edu, or call area code 607-255-7293, or send a blank email to subscribe-ithacas30@yahoogroups.com. subscribe-ithacas30@yahoogroups.com. The above events are sponsored by the Committee on U.S.-Latin American Relations, CUSLAR, Ithaca Coalition for Global Justice, the Sharks, and Akwe Khan. More information about the protests against the IMF and World Bank in Washington is available on the web at www.abolishthebank.org and www.globalizethis.org. That's abolishthebank.org and globalizethis.org.
Don't know good horse as we trot in this dark here, robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Will always be filled by